Chapter 13. Childhood Obesity. Alarmed by the stunning rise of obesity and type 2 diabetes in school-age children, hundreds of millions of dollars were deployed to counterattack. The first choice in our arsenal was the beloved Eat Less, Move More approach, which sported a perfect record unblemished by success. Nevertheless, as nutritional authorities scrambled to do battle, only one diet plan got the call. The U.S. National Institutes of Health funded the Healthy study, a large 3-year effort involving 42 schools in grades 6 to 8. Half of the schools would receive a multi-component intervention, while the other half continued their usual routines. The study encouraged certain nutritional and exercise goals, including lowering average fat content of food, providing at least 2 servings of fruit and vegetables per student, providing at least 2 servings of grain-based food and/or legumes, limiting dessert and snack foods to less than 200 calories per item, limiting beverages to water, low-fat milk, and 100% fruit juice, and encouraging more than 225 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week. Our old friend, Eat Less, Move More. Not too bright, but as familiar as an old blanket. There were classroom-based programs, newsletters for parents, social marketing, branding, posters, in-school announcements, student events and incentives, t-shirts, water bottles. Both groups began with roughly 50% of the students considered overweight or obese. By the end of the 3 years, the Eat Less, Move More group brought that down to 45%. Success! The group that followed their usual habits finished at 45%. There was no measurable benefit for the diet and exercise group. This weight loss strategy was virtually useless. But who hasn't tried the Eat Less, Move More approach and failed? The Healthy study was only the latest in an unbroken string of failures. Obesity, no longer just for adults. During the years 1977 to 2000, the prevalence of childhood obesity skyrocketed in every age category. Obesity in children aged 6 to 11 increased from 7% to 15.3%. For children aged 12 to 19, it more than tripled from 5% to 15.5%. Obesity-related diseases such as type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, previously rare in children, are becoming more common. Obesity has metastasized from being solely an adult concern to being a pediatric one, too. Childhood obesity also leads to adult obesity and future health problems, particularly cardiovascular issues. The Bogalusa Heart Study concluded, childhood obesity tracked into young adulthood, which is obvious to almost everybody. Childhood obesity is a predictor of increased mortality, but is, most importantly, a reversible risk factor. Overweight children who become normal weight as adults have the same mortality risk as those who have never been overweight. Obesity has begun to afflict younger and younger children. In one study covering a 22-year period ending in 2001, children of all ages show an increased prevalence of obesity, even in the 0 to 6-month-old age range. That finding is especially interesting. Conventional calorie-based theories of obesity are unable to explain this trend. Obesity is considered an energy balance problem, one of eating too much or exercising too little. Since 6-month-olds eat on demand and are often breastfed, it is impossible that they eat too much. Since 6-month-olds do not walk, it is impossible that they exercise too little. Similarly, birth weight has increased by as much as 0.5 pound, 200 grams, over the last 25 years. The newborn cannot eat too much or exercise too little. What is going on here? Numerous hypotheses have been offered to explain newborn obesity. One popular theory suggests that certain chemicals, obesogens, in our modern environment lead to obesity, chemicals that are often endocrine disruptors. That is, they disrupt the normal functional hormonal systems of the body. Since obesity is a hormonal rather than a caloric imbalance, this notion does not make some intuitive sense. Nonetheless, the majority of the data comes from animal studies. For example, the pesticides atrazine and DDE may cause obesity in rodents. However, no data is available for humans. Without such data, it is difficult to conclusively determine whether a chemical is an obesogen or not. Furthermore, studies use concentrations of chemicals that are hundreds or even thousands of times greater than normal human exposure. While these chemicals are almost certainly toxic, it is difficult to know how it applies to the common human condition of obesity. It's insulin. The answer is simpler once we understand hormonal obesity theory. Insulin is the major hormonal driver of weight gain. Insulin causes adult obesity. Insulin causes newborn obesity. Insulin causes infant obesity. Insulin causes childhood obesity. Where would an infant get high insulin levels? From his or her mother. Dr. David Ludwig recently examined the relationship between the weights of 513,501 women and their 1,164,750 offspring. Increased maternal weight gain is strongly associated with increased neonatal weight gain. Because both the mother and the fetus share the same blood supply, any hormonal imbalances, such as high insulin levels, are automatically and directly transmitted through the placenta from the mother to the growing fetus. Fetal macrosomia is a term used for fetuses that are large for their gestational age. There are a number of risk factors, but chief among them are maternal gestational diabetes, maternal obesity, and maternal weight gain. What do these conditions all have in common? High maternal levels of insulin. The high levels transmit to the developing fetus, resulting in one that is too large. The logical consequence of too much insulin in the newborn is the development of insulin resistance, which leads to even higher levels of insulin in a classic vicious cycle. The high insulin levels produce obesity in the newborn as well as the six-month-old infant. The origins of both infant obesity and adult obesity are the same: insulin. These are not two separate diseases, but two sides of the same coin. Babies born to mothers with gestational diabetes mellitus have three times the risk of obesity and diabetes in later life, and one of the biggest risk factors for obesity in young adulthood is obesity in childhood. Those who are obese in childhood have more than 17 times the risk of obesity going into adulthood. Even large for gestational age babies, whose mothers do not have gestational diabetes, are also at risk. They have double the risk of metabolic syndrome. The sad but inescapable conclusion is that we are now passing on our obesity to our children. Because we are now marinating our children in insulin starting in the womb, they develop more severe obesity sooner than ever before. Because obesity is time-dependent and gets worse, fat babies become fat children. Fat children become fat adults, and fat adults have fat babies in turn, passing obesity on to the next generation. What has really hampered our ability to combat childhood obesity, though, is a simple lack of understanding about the true causes of weight gain. A singular misguided focus on reducing caloric intake and increasing exercise led to government programs that have almost no chance of success. We didn't lack resources or willpower. We lacked knowledge of and a framework for understanding obesity. Same methods, same failures. Several large-scale studies on prevention of childhood obesity were started in the late 1990s. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute undertook the Pathways Study at a cost of $20 million over 8 years. Dr. Benjamin Caballero, director of the Center for Human Nutrition at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, led this ambitious effort involving 1,704 children in 41 schools. Some schools received the Special Obesity Prevention Program, while other schools continued their standard program. Low-income Native American children at risk for obesity and diabetes received both breakfast and lunch at the school cafeteria, where healthy food lessons were immediately reinforced. Special exercise breaks were introduced in the middle of the school day. The specific nutritional goal was to reduce dietary fat to less than 30%. In a nutshell, this was the same low-fat, low-calorie diet combined with increased exercise that had failed so miserably as a remedy for adult obesity. Did the children learn how to eat a low-fat diet? Sure did. Dietary fat started at 34% of calories and over the course of the study fell to 27%. Did they eat fewer calories? Sure did. The intervention group averaged 1,892 calories per day compared to 2,157 calories per day in the control group. Fantastic! The children were eating 265 fewer calories per day. They learned their lessons extremely well, eating fewer calories and less fat overall. Over the course of 3 years, calorie counters expected a loss of approximately 83 pounds. But did the children's weight actually change? Not even by a little bit. Physical activity was no different between the two groups. Despite the increased physical education done in the schools, the total physical activity measured by accelerometer was no different, which should have been expected given the known effect of compensation. Those children who were very active in school reduced their activity at home. Children relatively sedentary at school increase their activity once out of school. This study was vitally important. The failure of the low-fat, low-calorie strategy should have prompted a search for more effective methods of controlling the scourge of childhood obesity. It should have prompted soul-searching for the underlying cause of obesity and how to rationally treat it. So, what happened? The results were tabulated. The study was written. It was published in 2003 to thunderous silence. Nobody wanted to hear the truth. The eat less, move more approach, so adored by academic medicine, had failed yet again. It was easier to ignore the truth than to face it. And that's what happened. Other studies confirmed these results. Dr. Philip Nader from the University of California, San Diego, randomized 5,106 grade 3 to grade 5 students to education with healthy food and increased exercise. 56 schools received the special program, and 40 schools, the control group, did not. Once again, children receiving the extra indoctrination ate a lower-fat diet and retained this knowledge for years afterward. It was the largest school-based randomized trial ever conducted. They ate less and exercised more. They just didn't lose any weight. Obesity programs in community settings were similarly ineffective. The 2010 Memphis Girls Health Enrichment Multi-Site Studies involved 8 to 10-year-old girls in a Memphis community center. Group counseling encouraged subjects to reduce consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages and high-fat, high-caloric foods, increase intake of water, vegetables, and fruit. The message is very muddled here, but quite typical. Should we reduce sugar? Should we reduce fat? Should we reduce calories? Should we eat more fruit? Should we eat more vegetables? The program successfully reduced daily caloric intake from 1475 to 1373 at 1 year and further again to 1347 at 2 years. By contrast, the control group increased their daily caloric intake from 1379 to 1425 at 2 years. Did the girls lose weight? In a word, no. To add insult to injury, the body fat percentage increased from 28% to 32.2% at the end of 2 years. A stunning failure for all involved, and yet another demonstration of the powerful calorie deception at work. Calories do not drive weight gain, and thus reducing them will not lead to weight loss. But the persistently negative results were not enough to change ingrained beliefs. Both Drs. Caballero and Nader, rather than questioning their prior beliefs, felt that their treatments did not go far enough, a stance that is psychologically much, much easier to maintain. While this appears absurd, when it comes to childhood obesity, we appear to have accepted the status quo. A low-fat, low-calorie diet combined with exercise is proven ineffective for weight loss, a finding that confirms our own common sense and observations. But instead of rethinking our failed strategy, we just continue, hoping against all hope that this time it will work. Success at long last. Contrast that to the Australian Romp and Chomp study that ran from 2004 to 2008. The program targeted almost 12,000 children aged 0 to 5 years. Here again, daycare centers were divided into two groups. One group would continue their usual programs. The other intervention group received the Romp and Chomp educational initiative. But rather than giving multiple muddled health messages, the study's two major nutritional objectives were targeted and very specific. 1. To significantly decrease consumption of high sugar drinks and promote the consumption of water and milk. 2. To significantly decrease consumption of energy-dense snacks and increase consumption of fruit and vegetables. Rather than reducing fat and calories, the study reduced snacks and sugar. Similar to other programs, it tried to increase exercise and involve families as much as possible, but mostly, its methods were almost like your grandmother's advice to lose weight. 1. Cut down sugars and starches. 2. Stop snacking. These strategies attack the worst offenders of insulin secretion and resistance. Snacks tend to be cookies, pretzels, crackers, and other foods that are very high in refined carbohydrates, so reducing snacks reduced refined carbohydrates intake. Reducing sugar and refined carbohydrates will reduce insulin. Reducing snacking frequency prevents persistent high insulin levels, a key component of insulin resistance. These strategies lower insulin levels, the crucial central problem of obesity. The program decreased consumption of packaged snacks and fruit juice by approximately 1/2 cup daily. This study's results could not be more different from those of previous ones. Both the 2 and 3.5-year-old children showed significantly better weight reduction compared to the control group. The prevalence of obesity was reduced by 2% to 3%. Success at long last. In Southwest England, 6 schools launched a program called Ditch the Fizz. The single goal was to reduce soda drinking in children aged 7 to 11 years. The program succeeded in reducing daily consumption by about 5 ounces. 150 millimeters, which resulted in a decrease in obesity by 0.2%. While it may seem trivial, obesity increased among the control group by a massive 7.5%. Reducing the use of sugar-sweetened beverages is a highly effective method of preventing childhood obesity. This program was effective because it contained a very specific message: reduce soda consumption. Other programs are too ambitious and too vague, and often multiple mixed messages repeat in an endless loop. The importance of reducing intake of sugar-sweetened beverages can get lost in the cacophony. What your grandma said. While study after study showed the failure of conventional weight loss strategies, we plunged ahead with national exercise programs. We spent money and energy promoting exercise or building playgrounds in a misguided attempt to curb childhood obesity. When I grew up in the 1970s in Ontario, Canada, we had the Participation Program, which was revived in 2007 at a cost of $5 million. Participation's explicit aim is increasing physical activity in children, with a tagline of "Bring back play." Having watched my own children play exuberantly everywhere, I somehow doubt that play is in danger of disappearing. The original program that ran from the 1970s to the 1990s certainly failed to make a dent in the obesity crisis, but instead of burying these tired ideas, we resurrected them. Michelle Obama launched the Let's Move campaign with the ambitious goal of ending childhood obesity. Her strategy? Eat less, move more. Does she believe that this advice will work now, after 40 years of uninterrupted failure? Insulin, not calories, causes weight gain. It's not, and never was, a matter of restricting calories. It's a matter of reducing insulin. Despite the blunders, the news on childhood obesity is good. Recently, an unexpected ray of hope shone through the darkness. In 2014, the Journal of the American Medical Association reported that obesity rates for the age group 2 to 5 years had dropped by 43% between 2003 and 2012. There was no change in youth or adult rates of obesity. However, since childhood obesity is strongly linked to adult obesity, this is indeed very good news. Some groups wasted no time in congratulating themselves on a job well done. They believe that their campaign of physical activity and caloric reduction has played a key role in this success. I don't buy it. The answer is more straightforward. Consumption of added sugars steadily increased from 1977 along with obesity. By the late 1990s, increasing attention focused on the key role that sugars play in weight gain. The irrefutable truth remained that sugar causes weight gain, with no redeeming nutritional qualities. Sugar intake began to fall in 2000, and after a 5 to 10 year lag, so did obesity. We see this first in the youngest age group, since they have had the least exposure to high insulin levels and therefore have less insulin resistance. The most ironic part of this entire wretched episode is that we already knew the answers. The pediatrician Dr. Benjamin Spock wrote his classic Bible of child rearing, Baby and Child Care, in 1946. For more than 50 years, it was the second best-selling book in the world, after the Bible. Regarding childhood obesity, he writes, "Rich desserts can be omitted without risk, and should be, by anyone who is obese and trying to reduce. The amount of plain starchy foods, cereals, breads, potatoes, taken, is what determines how much weight they gain or lose." This, of course, was exactly what Grandma would say. Cut back sugars and starchy foods. No snacking. If only we had listened to Grandma instead of Big Brother.